Welcome to the 36th lesson in the book of Daniel. I've entitled it Leviathan's Union of Socialist Kingdoms. Our verses in this lesson come from Daniel chapter 7, verses 7 and 8. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great teeth of iron. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Now, to make sense of this, we need to go back and correlate it with Nebuchadnezzar's vision of chapter 2. And we notice that in Nebuchadnezzar's vision, it was broken up into two parts. You had the legs of iron and the feet of iron and clay. And we'll discuss why as we go through this. So in review, let's look at the legs of iron. Well, iron rots. Iron oxidizes, and once it starts oxidizing, it oxidizes all the way through. Once the corruption starts, it never stops until you either grind it out and reseal it, or it's destroyed. If you just paint over it, it will still continue to rust. And the two legs, because Rome was divided throughout most of its empire history. And it had obscure origins anyway, as we talked about at that time. But what it did do is it implemented admired qualities from other cultures, especially Etruscan. Many of the things that we call Roman were actually copied from the Etruscans. And I bet you'd go back and listen to those lectures, those lessons, to get a better sense of that. But the Etruscan was a highly successful and cultured civilization before Rome. And the Romans were basically rednecks of the peninsula and kind of just copied and eventually overcame. But the dividing, one of the significant differences between the two is that Etruscans were like Greeks. They were based upon the warrior hero. That sounds great. That sounds wonderful. But that doesn't work anymore. Because those who are the bravest and the strongest and the most powerful are killed off. Because they fight alone. Well, in the military, you don't fight alone. You fight in mass. And you overwhelm those. And then you eliminate them. And when you start eliminating that out of your culture loses its strength. Well, the Romans fought as units. And while each person was not as well-trained and not as brave probably and not as powerful by and large, in mass, they were overwhelming over time. And that was the key to Roman military success. If you look at the victories, they're like Napoleon's victories. Some were great, but they lost as often as they won. Napoleon lost his battles as often as he won battles. He didn't mind the cost. And notice you have the two legs because you have the East and West empires. And because it's a man, in the form of a man, though it's not a man, it's hollow, it's metal, it's not alive. It looks wonderful from the outside, but it's not alive. It's like proclaiming godliness but denying its power. You're hollow. You have nothing. You're not godly. Because to be godly means you have to have God's nature in you. You have to be saved. Though it has the familiaritude of a man, it isn't. And this we understand quite well from Daniel's vision, which is God's perspective on the true nature of these kingdoms. And they are all beasts. They're all animals. We've talked about that in the past, that all sinners who are born, that's all of us, were born with a demented or twisted aspect of God's nature. We're animals. We act like animals. We think like animals. We pretend to be men because that's what we were at one point, way back in Adam before he fell. But we're animals. We slaughter like animals. We copulate like animals. We're proud of being animals. And notice even the small horn speaks like a man. But it's not a man. And as I said, we've talked about this in the past, and we're going to talk about it later on in this lesson to build upon that. All sinners, and we're all born sinners, are with this corrupted nature. And Satan is always seen as a beast. Always. That's why his metaphor is dragon or worm. And so it's from man, as man is the measure of all things on his way to being as God. Except that's little g. Because the little g God is not the big G God. Little g God is really Luciferianism, of which paganism and idolatry was an early form. And notice, it was almost always animals. Man was worshiping his sinful nature and proud of it in the form of creation. But Roman government crumpled due to relativism. That was the rust. You couldn't paint over it. You couldn't cover it up with money. You couldn't cover it up with military victories. You couldn't cover it up by copying Hellenistic philosophy. In fact, that actually made it worse. Yet it became the foundation of Western culture. What was the legacy of Rome? Well, it was the failure of strength. So we all concentrate on the strength of Rome, but it was the failure of strength that was the legacy of Rome. See, Romanism continues to influence, straining toward a Roman globalism. Now, we all envisioned that in past decades as military power. The more military power you had, the more hegemony you had, the greater you were at dominating the world. Now we think like that, but the reality is quite different. America has ultimate power to destroy in its nuclear weapons. What is the provocation that justifies destroying entire cultures? In other words, having the atomic weapons has made us almost absolutely weak. And so we go around fighting these regional conflicts, declared and undeclared, that sap us. Destroy the flower of our youth over decades. Destroy our treasure and accomplish nothing as far as the nation is concerned. It is the failure of strength. And so while today conservative and liberal worship the military, literally, we have more holidays devoted to military than to any other single cause. We worship it as a culture. It is still the failure of strength. It's like a magnifying glass. You can focus those light rays on a very tiny point and cause a combustible to ignite. But over that wide area, you do nothing. Your light is diffused. You accomplish nothing. And the influence of Romanism on Western culture is even contained in the titles. The German Kaiser, which is pronounced correctly as concerns the old Latin, is the same as the Russian Tsar, which is the same as the English Caesar. And Kaiser and Tsar were used as titles for the head rulers of those countries. Medieval feudalism serfdom grew out of Western Roman agricultural socialism. See, Rome's practice of buying the masses off with cheap grain, cheap bread actually, or free bread at times, meant that farmers could not get market prices for the grain. In other words, they were going into the hole just growing the grain and selling it to the government, or the government confiscating it. And so farmers were leaving their farms and going to the city to get free bread. It became so bad during the empire years that they passed laws forbidding farmers to leave their farms. Serfdom. They encoded it in law to keep them tied in a virtual slavery on their farms to the empire. Well, when old Western Romanism faded away, this system remained in place and grew throughout Europe. That's where it came from. That is socialism. Government control of prices or products and wages always leads to socialism. Always. And through Augustine's worship of Platonism and Romanism, Roman Catholicism gained dominance and hid the true gospel during the Dark Ages. Roman Catholicism is built on Neoplatonism. Until Thomas Aquinas, when it became challenged by Thomas's adoption of Aristotelian philosophy, of Aristotle. But Neoplatonism never went away. It was just kind of laid over the top of it. And the new nation states were militaristic, expansionistic oligarchies, increasingly using democratic mob rule to solidify socialistic practices and policies, ensuring a return to serfdom. This is what modern socialism is all about. It's not about equality and raising everybody up to march arm in arm into this glorious, prosperous future. ever. It's about returning you to serfdom. As Friedrich Hayek wrote his book, The Road to Serfdom. He recognized this in the 1930s. What was happening in Hitler's Germany? He saw the seeds of it in Chamberlain and Churchill's England, and later in America. And we are indeed going downhill faster and faster on this road, willingly, into socialism. And of course, Romanism is overlaid on top of Hellenism, as we discussed in our last lesson. Man, the measure of all. Secularism, man is God. Evolutionism, God's not needed because man is an animal. Evolution philosophy reduces man to animalism. We are just another species. As we're constantly reminded in sci-fi shows and science shows, and these are just elements of various propaganda channels to give us confirmational bias that embraces our sin, embraces that philosophy as being true and wonderful and great, when in fact it is degrading and debasing and breeds violence leading to death. Both the first death, separation of body and soul, which we call dying, and the second death, which is separation from God for eternity. And Pareto worship, expressed in Washington's apotheosis in America's capital, was begun in Rome for Western cultures. You could have any religion you want to, as long as it was approved by the state, as long as you sacrifice that literally incense pinch to the emperor. You had to do that. Laying the framework for worshiping the image of the beast, the Antichrist. The mark is just proof that you've done that. In ancient Rome, you were given parchment, a piece of paper, as we would say. And you would flash that every time you were asked, did you do that this year? Yes, here's my paper, I did it. Here's my parchment, say I did it. Okay, you're good. But if you couldn't produce that, you had to do it on the spot. And if you didn't, you were executed. Laying the groundwork for that which is to come. The great and terrible beast was in its infancy in ancient Rome. See, the Roman West influenced Europe. But the Roman East, which is mainly an expression of its Hellenistic trappings, influenced the Middle East, Mesopotamia area, and up into Eurasia, or today what we would call Russia. Or in the Bible, Gog and Magog. It has gone nearly everywhere. And as Oriental countries adopt Western practices, guess what? They take this poison in. And it overlays their own form of poison. Because it's all sin. But this iron, while it seems so strong, stands on a fragile base of iron and clay, what's commonly referred to as the revived Roman Empire. It's a kingdom future to us, though based on Romanesque principles. It builds on previous kingdoms, but adds a unique semi-metallic digital dimension. Now, when we talked about this in chapter 2, we looked at the iron, the strength of it. And we looked at the clay, democracy, man intermixed. The voting, the commonality and union of all people having the franchise to vote is not strength. Not in Satan's plan. It's divided. It's rebellious. It's hard to contain. And it's brittle. Easily fractured. But there's another dimension to clay. Clay can also represent semiconductors, which is the basis of the digital age. Or as World Economic Forum says, the fourth industrial revolution is the digital age. It is made possible by semiconductors. Putting tens of thousands of transistors, so to speak, on these small and smaller and smaller central processing chips. Such that our machines today do wonderful things, but they are being used to enslave us. They're being used to focus our attention, to make us desire them, but being controlled from more and more concentrated, centralized control to guide us and lead us willingly, like cattle to the slaughter, into serfdom. Now, history cannot define this empire. It's future to us. And prior empires only give us clues about its nature, as Daniel is doing here also. And interpretations focused on identifying this empire, well, that's just stupid. That just results in bizarre fantasies. And I've heard them over the years. God says you will not know until it's time for you to know. Then it will be revealed and everyone will know. But until that point in time, we are to rest in faith. So this vision defines what each empire adds to Satan's final empire. If you look in Daniel chapter 2, each of those elements go into the totality of Satan's final empire, as we talked about in our past lesson. Each of these beasts are not separate and distinct insofar as they totally pass off and their influence is gone away to be replaced by the next empire. And the influences of the previous empire are just wiped away. That's not what's happening. Each is building upon the other. And this here, this beast here, is Satan's final empire. But in God's view, the old and the new were actually one. It's a continuation. It has never gone away. And it is coming back with a vengeance. But it's coming back in an altered form. It's not a governmental form. It's that which lies behind the government, which even the government depends on, and thus is controlled by. And we let the Bible define Bible. Like we let math define math. Because otherwise we end up with fantasies. Many a faith has been made shipwrecked. speculating and running around looking for this kingdom and its influence. Excuse me. But it is not for now. It is not for us to know. Because it's not here yet. It's only being built slowly, slowly, slowly. And so what is Satan's future kingdom? Well, it's government and religion together. See, this iron and clay evidence this reliance of both digital and religion communications and foundations to captivate the world to Satan's delusion. Religion forms the foundation of all values. Now, you can deny that all you want to, but that which informs your values of right and wrong, as you define them, is your religion. Because, guess what? That's what the Bible does. God codified right and wrong in the 10 words. The rest of the Mosaic Law just gives instructions on how to implement this in both in the temple as well as in everyday social life for that time period, to drive them to understand that this was not attainable by man and throw themselves on God's mercy, which was always there, never went away. And we see, and we've studied this in past lessons, where Satan is standing on the shore of the sea, calling for his numerous representatives. And we see it here in Daniel 7, and we see it again in Revelation 13. See, you cannot understand Revelation if you do not understand the Old Testament, because much of that imagery comes out of the Old Testament. They're all interleaved together, interdependent. And the false prophet arise from the land, while the Antichrist arise from the sea, the raging sea of sin and Satan. Whereas a false prophet, he comes from the land, receiving the power of Satan to promote Antichrist's government via a umbrella-type religion that unites all these false faiths into one. Remember the old Roman Empire? You can believe anything you want to, if it's approved. You need that caveat. As long as you burn that pinch of incense to the emperor. As long as you submit to whatever that image will be that the false prophet sets up, you will receive its mark. But if you don't, it will not go well for you. See, man, the measure of all things is the delusion, because Satan shares power with no one. And he is the measure of all things. John 8:44. You are of your father the devil, Christ told the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And he was a liar and a murderer from the beginning of his sin. We all are born with Satan as our father. We're all conceived in iniquity, Psalms 51:5. And this idol is built with the consent of the governed. And they willingly place themselves in bondage. Now that is another aspect of what iron means in the scripture. It's bondage. It's these chains of iron hold us. And we're willingly putting them on our arms
and around your neck and on our feet, enslaving ourselves. But guess what? We were already enslaved to Satan since conception. And we cling to him. And we love him. With kind of a love-hate relationship. Because it's impossible apart from God to have true love. But we do it for gain, for expression. Because we want it. We want to be powerful. We want control over others, because that's what sin is. Sin is not joining hands together in some kind of placid, tranquil, peaceful, equality, marching arm in arm into the future. I think sin is rebellious. Sin is survival of the fittest. Evolution encapsulates that, and everybody has been taught to believe that. That is what nature is. Survival of the fittest. And guess what? You're an animal. Ergo, without actually saying it, you are then, being an animal, survival of the fittest. But as Cain discovered, you can't have a society based on rebellion. You have to control it. Otherwise, it self-destructs. And you can't be king if you don't have people to be king over. You just don't need so many of them. Because then they get harder to control. So all who worship the Antichrist, who points to Satan, are allowed to live in a centralized, rationed economy based on ungodly or Asabaean morality. This is the old world, this is this world, this is the coming world. But this is not Christ's rule. Now Daniel here, as we read in verse 7, starts off like he did in verse 2. Vision in the night. He's emphasizing this night. Because night is the time of Satan. This is the dominion of Satan. Now I would take you to Matthew chapter 6, starting in verse 22.
The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light.
But if your eye is evil, if your eye is single, that's what it means, single. Your whole body will be full of darkness.
Now, we define darkness as the absence of light. Because in the physical realm, that's what it is. Darkness is the absence of light, or the suppression of light. But in the spiritual world, darkness is an active force.
If then the light in you is darkness, so you have this active force, but it's not illuminating, it's suffocating. It's evil. Then how great is that darkness? This is what Christ is saying here.
John says the same thing over in the opening hymn of the book of John. If you want to understand John, you have to understand the opening hymn, because John is patterned on that opening hymn. And if you go to John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And he's talking about Christ. Christ is the active agent, the interface between the Father, who is outside of this creation, and the shaper and mover inside this creation. That is what Christ is. Of course, he is the light. When God said, "Let there be light," it is Christ entering into this creation
to shape it, to fashion it, and to die in it. So the whole Trinity is present and active in creation. And in verse 5, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Once again, it is not the absence of light. It is an active force seeking to destroy and suppress and remove that light. This is not physical elements here. This is a spiritual battle. And Christ in verse 9, the true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. And he was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. We see by the light that is in us. We perceive by the light that is in us. And if the light in you is darkness, then guess what? You see darkness, and you only see the things that the dark illuminates, which is evil and sinful. It's like putting on night vision goggles. You don't see light. You see by its unique light in the darkness. And you only see it in the form that it illuminates back to you. It's not like daylight. And so this whole concept of night, we need to understand it. Because Daniel is not talking about the absence of light. He's talking about an active spiritual force that is at work to literally suppress the light of God. And that is over the raging sea. Once again, another metaphor for negative spiritual forces at work, demonic forces at work, Satan forces at work. He is the Leviathan in the sea, as well as the Leviathan standing on the shore, calling forth these kingdoms. And this fourth beast or kingdom that arises from the sea is terrifying. Why? Because he is revealing himself directly. There is no need to put it in familiar form anymore. But there's also another reason for it. Let's look at the numbers first. Four, it means completeness, as this is the culmination of Satan's kingdom on earth. Whereas Nebuchadnezzar saw two different associated kingdoms, God shows Daniel that both are one continual kingdom. Satan's goal since Adam. Now we talked about that. We had the iron legs and the feet in iron of clay, two different, apparently, kingdoms, but related. And from God's perspective, they're not different. They are one and the same, and it's just a process of growing from one into the other based upon that which has gone before. It is not brand new. There is nothing new under the sun. Satan does nothing new, nor do we. We cannot. We are limited by our sinful nature, which is crippling. And we only understand and perceive that which is within this creation. We have no concept of outside this creation. In fact, just trying to imagine nothing. No space, no dark, no light, no dimensions, no three dimensions, nothing. Overwhelms the mind. And yet, out of whatever this absolutely nothing, 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 God made the three dimensions. He made space. The Father brought material into this space. And then the Son fashioned it within the space to form the creation that we see around us, even the universe. So this four is completeness, the four corners of the compass, the four corners of the earth, the four winds of heaven. Always about completeness. Well, 10 builds upon this union of completeness by adding the number 6, man. And it stands for law. Now, it could stand for God's law, because 10 words. And when you go to Exodus 20 and my lessons on that, you discover that that is divided into two parts, and man's portion of the law is built upon the sin of covetousness, which is idolatry. Colossians 3:5. It is idolatry. It is the basis of all idolatry. It is the basis of all sin, is covetousness. This wanting what God has not given forms the basis of every sin. Satan's kingdom will be built on the law of lux talionis, or retaliation, or the law of the claw, or the survival of the fittest, of which Hammurabi's code, which is much touted, was actually a law of death. Even for minor infractions, you would be killed. But it was also an economic control. Fixing prices. And we know how well that works. And the Bronze Age was actually wholesale socialism. And guess what? It collapsed. It collapsed into a dark age. And it collapsed for a couple hundred years. And there were nearly every kingdom went out of existence. And those few that remained intact were terribly weakened. And those revived again. And grew and culminated in the old Roman Empire, but even it too was divided and weakened. And while it passed out of existence, it did not pass out of influence. It remained the focus of every kingdom that came into being in the territory that it controlled in Europe and Eurasia. So we see that Satan's law is going to be horrendous. It's going to be ironclad. It's going to be without mercy. And it's going to be socialistic. The Jews give us an example of this. See, the Jews took God's 10 words and perverted them. Well, not only that, they took the entire law and perverted it. Whereas God's law, the social law, it was burdensome. It absolutely was. But they embraced it and made it worse. Thinking, if I keep this, and God will love me. Except one infraction, and you violated the law. The law has no mercy. There is no weighing in the balance for the good outweighs the evil. One infraction, and you are condemned under the law. Same way with Satan's law. Only God offers mercy. Satan offers death. God offers a way of escape through Christ. Satan offers no way of escape. You die. And that's what they did. The Jews took God's law, which pointed and sought to push you toward Christ. That was the whole purpose of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. Or so Christ, to show the Jews how they missed understanding the 10 words. How they missed understanding the law. How they misused the Sabbath, which is that time for them to meditate upon God's word and God's grace and point to the mercy and compassion of God as a way of escape. And you know, that is the only escape that God offers for temptation, is himself. Eternal death. Otherwise, we stand condemned. Our own flesh condemns us because it succumbs to temptation. The way of escape is Christ from the penalty of sin and temptation. Thus, the Jewish law became Satan's law of slavery and death. And you know something? It killed Christ to enslave everyone. Let's go to Mark 3. Verses 1 through 6. Christ is in a synagogue, a local assembly, coming together to study God. Well, not really. To study the law. To fix that law. To establish that morality. And to force everyone to live by that morality. Today we call it public school. Because if you look at the history in America of public school, it arose in New England, Massachusetts specifically, in the early 1800s, 1820s, to enforce Protestant values and beliefs and morality over everyone. And then we'll educate you on the side, baby. Well, in the 1960s, that was thrown off. And they began teaching a different morality. Because they got tired of Protestant morality. Because morality, by law, is not salvation. You're just as dead in eternity. One is just slightly more honest than the other, I guess. So in this synagogue is a man with a withered hand. He can't work. He's crippled. And Christ is going to heal him. And he asks him, is it better to do good or to do harm? To save or to kill? To live under this law that has no mercy? Or come to Christ? Come to God, who is the God of mercy and compassion. And they chose the law of death. And Christ, grieved and angered at their hardness of heart, said, stretch out your hand. And the hand was restored. And the Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. That is what Satan's law does. Make no mistake. The embracing of law and order is the law of rex talionis, retaliation. And I know I'm mispronouncing that, but Latin is not a language I've studied. So why do I say Leviathan, a metaphor of Satan's kingdom? Well, Daniel describes this fourth beast as terrifying and dreadful and very, very strong. This beast is not directly linked to any known animal. So Daniel must give a description of how powerful this beast is so we understand its metaphor. The three previous kingdoms were linked to men and thus were given noble animal metaphors. Lion, bear, cheetah. But this kingdom is not of this world. In other words, Satan is not using these intermediaries who are being used without their knowledge. The Antichrist is not being used without his knowledge. He is knowledgeable about the power that he has tapped into. It's not medieval Satan worship or anything like that. I mean, that's just silly. What was happening here is this kingdom, not of this world, but powered by Satan, whose metaphor throughout the Bible is the dragon, the serpent, or the worm, that runs throughout Revelation. Like Revelation 12:9 tells us that he is that dragon, that worm of old. And Isaiah links Satan to the 11th thorn in Isaiah 27:1. Remember, when God asked Job if he could tame the Leviathan, he was not referring to specifically the animal only, but to Satan. And no one can tame the Leviathan. No one can tame Satan. We are all children of him, born in sin. We cannot control him. He controls us. And thus, remember, Satan is an animal. He is an angel. Angels do not have our nature. Our nature comes from God. Satan's an angelic nature is fixed. It likes that law thing. You sin, you die. God has restrained the seraphim. They tear this world, this universe apart because it is contaminated. It violates the holiness of God. That's why when Christ entered heaven and he stood before, let's see, on the lid of the ark, who's looking down on him? Seraphim. Ready to tear him apart if there was any taint of unholiness on him. And he passed their gaze to offer himself before the Father. It's in Hebrews. None of us can pass that gaze. That is why human sacrifice is so ridiculous. You die, you go up there, your soul is tainted with sin. Even after salvation, we're tainted. We're just clothed in Christ's righteousness. That is what passes the gaze of the seraphim. Thus, Satan can only think in these black and white terms. He really doesn't understand us. And you know something? You don't care. Because his control of us is part of his defense against proving God is guilty of evil and therefore incapable of proper judgment. He's trying to escape his own fate. And you don't care how many of you he got killed, just so you know. And yet, the sinners, we all embrace him. And he doesn't care one whit. Like socialism today, everyone embraces it, votes for it, wants it, but don't care one whit for you. It's going to enslave you, and if it don't need you, it's going to destroy you. And thus, Leviathan probably could not survive the post-diluvial world. Living in the ocean, he probably survived the cataclysm and stuff. And probably lived for a time thereafter. So in the time of Job, they would have seen him. They would have known about him. But by the time of Daniel, he's gone. He's just legend. And today, he's mythical legend. Now, we come to the ten horns. Now, in Scripture, horn means power. It could be a metaphor for a king. It could be a metaphor for an empire. It could be a metaphor for an ethnicity. It is power. It is control. Whenever you say power in respect to man, you should be thinking control. Because that is what power is used for. It's control. Governmental power and control. And these kingdoms, these 10 kingdoms, are based on Satan's law of lex talionis, unmerciful in its judgment. And we're going to see just how unmerciful it is. And it permeates every worldly kingdom from a common source. Remember, there's only one body. Whatever it is, it's a terrible body. Now, you'll see many pictures of artist's conception of this fourth beast. Sometimes they'll have them as lions, sometimes leopards, dinosaurs, the terrible lizards, that's what dinosaur means. But none of those are really descriptive. I chose dragon because that's what most people think of. And it's mythical, but it's terrible. You can't fight against the myth, but it can certainly destroy you because you believe. And it appears strong, these 10 kingdoms. But they're managed to prevent mutual assured destruction. Remember the Cold War? Mad? Mutual assured destruction? That was how the two superpowers were going to defend themselves, because that's all government knows how to do is destroy. It knows how to tax, it knows how to kill, and it knows how to destroy. Government doesn't produce anything, it doesn't produce wealth, it robs wealth in the form of taxes or outright confiscation, and it only knows how to project destructive power. It must be managed. And that is what the 20th century taught us. Governments have to be managed or they will destroy each other. Willingly. And their citizens just sit there and say, yay, our side will win. But there'll be nothing left. It doesn't matter, we won. This is the incoherency and stupidity of sin. Now, it may correlate to 10 actual governments or regions, or it may simply denote Satan's completeness. This is permeating throughout every society, every governmental power, even in our time. Now the small horn arises. Now the small horn is small. It does not appear to be equal to the other 10 horns. And yet, it has eyes like a man. It's not a man. But it's speaking things. Terrible things. Domineering things. It has somewhat of a similitude of a man. That'd be the Antichrist. But he's not. Because the power behind him is the dragon. And he himself is a beast. Because he embraces the power of the dragon. In fact, if you go to Revelation 13, you'll see he has 10 horns on his head. That is just a metaphor again. Linking right back here to Daniel. But the other horns have no such characteristics. They're blind. And they're mute. In other words, the small horn is leading them. The small horn is guiding them. The small horn is controlling them. The horn speaks to dominate. And if you're not going to follow, you get uprooted. I mean ripped out by your roots. No partial. It's either you follow or you are totally eliminated. And he takes direct control of your dominion. And there's 7 left. Once again, perfect completeness. So he takes care of those 3 rebellious 10 law through the law of Rex Talionis. And now he has complete control of these governments. Well, how does he do this? Well, the smallest denotes deception. Because it's the most powerful leader. It's deceptive. Satan is deceptive. He always works behind the scenes. His spirit and we're not. But it's able to completely dominate the large horns to form a more perfect union. It's a power unto itself from Satan, of course. We see that in Revelation 13. This is just another facet of the Antichrist who arises from the sea. Satan always works behind the scene until it is time to strike, and then he strikes hard. And that is what he'll be doing with this kingdom. Stomping and tearing iron teeth. While people fixate on the power of governments, which we already talked about, governments are totally dependent on finances. See, governments don't produce nothing. But they need money, because power is expensive. Military is expensive. Wars are expensive. Not only equipment and men and training and so on and so forth expensive, but these people you've taken out of society to put in your military have weakened you because they're not producing any wealth, any services, any value. So the larger your military, the weaker you make yourself. I mean, come on. This doesn't take a genius to figure this out. This is just simple Aristotelian logic. Law of identity. Law of non-contradiction. Law of excluded middle. Law of logical inferences. And yet it seems to be beyond the pale of understanding for most people. Because they have believed the delusion. Governments produce nothing. You want to know? Where truth lies? Follow the money. Remember, the love of money is the root of all evil. 1 Timothy 6:10. Not money, love of it. Because it's the love of control. Which is enmity against God. James 4, 1 through 4. Whereas James is talking to the Christians who are confused at best. This also applies to the law, lost, who embrace it with a vengeance. See, Alexander Magus, the Great, he squandered his great hoard of Persian gold. So much so, he devalued gold on the open market. And that just shows you how stupid he was. He may have been smart on the battlefield with Satan behind him, protecting him, and God allowing him to have those victories. But he was an idiot. Not only dry in a drunken stupor, choking on his own vomit, but he didn't understand the true power in his hands of all that gold, all that finance, that used judiciously, would bring all these nations to him. Roman military power was axiomatic, but variable, as we talked about. When you think Rome, you think army. But the true source of the empire's longevity was a constant source of fiscal power. The Iberian or Spanish gold mines. That for 200-300 years kept the empire supplied with financial power. Which is why the Eastern Empire lasted for so long. Because of the trade routes and their taxation. Money is what powers governments. But Rome's power waned as the basis for their monetary system waned, the gold and the silver. And the revived empire financial tier will fuel. Are you ready? Will fuel its corporate government control. We've talked about in our posts, in the 20th century, late 19th into the 20th century and throughout the 20th century, you had government married to corporatism, but government was the senior partner. But during the 20th century, that relationship began to change so that corporatism, by the time you reach the 21st century, corporatism is becoming the dominant power because of the financiers behind it. They're all international. And corporations are functioning internationally. And sovereign national governments are becoming irrelevant. It's already in the works. It's already in the mix. It's because of these financial controls. And if you're following on the slide, you notice the logos up here. That is the Fabian Society, the wolves in sheep's clothing. You hide yourself. You're deceptive. You sneak. You lie. And yet, when you strike hard. When Satan is ready, he will strike hard. The beast that stomps. The beast that enslaves. Now, Satan's finiteness is a closed pie system. Socialism. Distributing equality by force. And that is really what socialism is. It's making everybody equal by force. Because remember, sinners are rebellious. You don't want to be less equal. You don't want to be equal with less. You want to be above everyone else. You are the hero of your own story. That's what worldview does. You are always right. You're always king. And everybody else around you is always stupid. Unless you need them as allies, and then they're kind of smart. Until you don't need them no more. Then they're stupid. See, God is infinite. He can give to everyone as much as he determines they need, since he cannot be exhausted. And he can have a relationship with everybody, uniquely, individually, simultaneously. Why? Because he's infinite. Christ will know you personally, intimately. And he does it with everybody simultaneously because he's infinite. He's God. He can do that. He cannot be exhausted. He can give what everyone needs and not be exhausted, not run out. But Satan is finite. Man is finite. We're created beings. We cannot create anything. Christ, the basket, 2 fish, 4 loaves, fed a crowd of 5,000. God was creating right there. There's no reach to the basket. He was creating. We can't do that. And we look at this earth, well, the resources are fixed. We're running out. Well, that implies omniscience. And that we know how much resources total there are. And we know the processes. And we know everything. Which, of course, we don't. It's because we're finite and we can't know those things. Or at least right now, we don't know those things. And so we're always afraid of running out. But this is the heart of the fixed pie mentality. Is that I am finite. This creation is finite. This earth is finite. Everything is finite. It's fixed. It cannot expand. We cannot get new stuff. So we have to ration it. We have to control it. And since I can't have a relationship with everybody intimately simultaneously, though some people do try, that's what polygamy is. It never works. We must do it through control so that everybody is forced lockstep to be in chains lest they rebel and everything falls apart. You guys remember, sin is rebellion. And sinners reject the infinite God to embrace the fallen, finite being who rules by violence and degradation. That's what they do. That's what I did. And the immature believer has a hard time changing. And that is what the Hagiazo process is about. To bring us to the end. To overwhelm us so that we turn to God. And God teaches us out of His Word. Satan rations what God freely gives. Because God is infinite. And Satan uses the criteria of equality to ration. Well, everyone has to have the same amount. It has to be done equally. And since it's fixed, we have to give everybody, you get less. Because guess what? It's not just today, but it's 10 years from now. It's 100 years from now. So you get nothing. You get a little tiny. And that's what finiteness does. It promises the world. It gives you little bitty stuff. Little stuff. Controlled by the financiers. Controlled by the Antichrist. Who's controlling corporatism, which is controlling government. And those who are left are the serfs. Working to supply the delicacies for the elite. That is what socialism does. That is what the 10 kingdoms are. Well, the 7 kingdoms. They are the union of socialist kingdoms under the Leviathan. God made this creation temporary. Satan and his government seek to rule here forever. Except they ain't no forever here. No one escapes judgment. As a saved person, you did not escape judgment. When you repented, you judged yourself. But you only did that because God illuminated your mind. And you saw reality. And you judged yourself unworthy. And clung to Christ. Christ did not escape judgment. He underwent judgment for you. So that you didn't have to. But the lost will face judgment directly. And we see that in Revelation 20. That whole chapter has to do with that. The insanity is doing the same thing and expecting different. Satan does not change. He can't change. Ecclesiastes 1:1-11. This world does not change. It's just the stage dressing that changes. He just uses more refined techniques to expand his control. He is trapped by his angelic nature in sin. Just like we, when we're lost, are trapped by our sin and our nature, our fallen nature. This final kingdom represents Satan's ultimate and unvarnished effort to establish his ultimate kingdom. That's what he wants to do. Establish his ultimate kingdom on earth. The small horn represents the head of a union, subordinate kingdoms. Those who rebel are dramatically ripped up. Remember, you don't worship that image. You die on the spot. You don't accept the truth, their truth. You die on the spot. And those three regions that reject the Antichrist rule, those three governments that said, no, you're not going to do it. They get ripped up. They're gone. There is direct control. You know, in old Rome, you either had a military ruler over you, governor, or you had a civilian. If you were compliant and considered non-rebellious, you had a civilian. You had looser control. But if you were rebellious, you were considered a threat, you had a military governor with, you were under direct control of Rome. That is what Judea was. Satan mimics Christ but cannot achieve a comparable kingdom as Christ, as he is finite while Christ is infinite. And due to sin's insecurity, because remember, Satan's not fooled. He knows the truth. Satan responds with anger and force to control rebellious, sinful mankind, which is probably why he wants population control and to eke out the resources for the elites. That'd be eugenics, too. Because it's got to last forever. Because God's not creating anymore. So whatever we got to use sparingly, which means that it's more for us, less for you. Satan's laws of control reject God's moral law. They are relative to himself, and they change based on lies. God's law is absolute and immutable. And finally, last days, Satan on earth establishing his union. With Christ's death, resurrection, and ascension, Satan was cast to the earth. And he knows his time is short, predetermined, unchangeable. Habakkuk 2, verses 1 through 3. Revelation 12, 7 through 12. He is working with ever-increasing levels of violence and death to ready his confederated empire before Christ's imminent but unknowable return. It can happen at any moment. It's just no one knows the moment except the Father. Thus, these are called the latter or last days. And they coincide with the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is a process of judgment that begins upon Christ's return and continues until the heavens and the earth, this physical creation, melts with a fervent heat. And work as hard as he will, Satan and sinners will not avail, but show themselves worthy of their fiery judgment. Because they love money and power, and it condemns them. And they love the evil, and rejected the truth. Well, they're blind to the truth. They're under the delusion. But to pull them out, they will fight you. They will hate you. They will attack you. They will kill you. As they did the prophets. As they did Christ. As they did Paul and the apostles. And as it's done throughout history. And will continue to do so during the Great Tribulation. And Christians who focus on the world run the risk of losing their first love, Christ. Because of Satan's seeming invincibility. Where else can we go, though, but to Christ? There is no other place. Who else has the words of life? Peter said this in John 6, verses 60 through 67. Christ is, in John, had fed the 5,000, and they sought him out, and they ran around the Sea of Galilee to find him again. And he said, "What? You just want to be fed." But in John 6, verses 60 through 70, not 67, Christ is sitting there after all these 5,000 left, and many of the disciples. So it's not just the 12 is following. It's a crowd of disciples. Not the intimate circle, but almost. And they're following him. And they left too. And Christ turns to the 12 and said, will you go also? Now, he's not dejected. They all go, he didn't care. He cares, but he cannot change his message. He's from the Father. This is his mission. And they would go also, except God is revealing to them the truth. And Peter says, where else can we go? You have the words of life. Many times in my life since I've been a Christian, I've gotten discouraged. And I've gotten overwhelmed. Because it's like standing out in a terrible gale and speaking, and you can't hear your own words. Nobody is listening. Nobody cares. Everyone is blind. And we're just teaching the Bible. Orthodox Bible. And nobody cares. Where can I go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God. Once you believe that, there is no other place to go. There is no left or right, liberal, conservative. There is only one spot, and any deviation from that one spot is sinisterism with the religion of Luciferianism. It doesn't matter what government it is. If it's not of Christ, it is of Satan. And we must be careful. Because he will pull us off the mark a bit at a time. There's so much in this lesson. And I do apologize. It ran a little bit longer than I expected. This is what is contained in this fourth piece. Now, we're not done with this piece. Daniel is going to talk about them more and more. We're just scratching the surface in this lesson. And so I hope to see you in the subsequent lessons. Thank you.